Hi, my name is Nick Glennie-Smith. I'm composer for Man in the Iron Mask, and I'm thrilled that Milan are putting it out again. How I came to film music, it's a long and arduous road. I started as a chorister in an English cathedral at age 8 to 13, like a couple of other of my colleagues in film writing did also. And I think it's a fantastic experience to be that malleable sort of person at that age and sing fantastic music with a really professional choir in such an amazing acoustic space as a cathedral. It's stunning. You know, you're learning sight reading different things every day. It's just thoroughly good musical education while you don't even realize you're being educated. And then after that, the Beatles came along, and I always thought that they'd get too old and they'd need replacements, and I'd like to be one of those replacements one day. Sadly, that didn't happen, but I got into rock and roll quite heavily then. I was in bands through my teenage years, and then moved back to London from Yorkshire, where I was living for a while in the early 70s, and started working in a recording studio, learning engineering. I always thought anything that could make an idea sound great through a pair of speakers, there's lots of processes involved in that one large leap, and I thought anything I can learn on the way is a good idea. Also, I'd actually worked at this guy's studio when it was a very quirky 12-track studio, I think using 6 2-track machines all running together. Don't ask me how, but it was a great way of learning disciplines, which in old analog days you actually needed to know. You needed to know how to line up a tape machine and all that, so it came back sounding good. And while I was engineering, I then started doing playing, and then in the 80s I was doing just lots of sessions, playing on loads of different sorts of projects, mostly records, a lot of which you've probably heard and a lot of which you haven't, lucky you. That was fun. And around the same time, I joined a company in London called Airedale that make, in those days, used to make commercials primarily, music production company, if you like. There were probably about 12 or 14 writers there, none of whom sort of relied on writing commercials as the backbone of their living. They're all doing other things, you know, session players or producers or songwriters or whatever, but it was just jolly good fun. Commercials are great because you know, if you've got to write a 30-second piece, you can get it finished, do a demo in like 3 hours, and you know the next day whether they like it or not. And if they do, then they pay you shitloads of money, and if they don't, then you've got an idea that you didn't have to start with. So it's very good training. And there's an old friend of mine, Hans Zimmer, who I've known even before those days, was an Airedale composer, as was a film composer called Stanley Myers, who is sadly passed on now. But he gave a whole bunch of us there our first cues to write, really. I think Stanley was, like most of us are, just a sort of girl that can't say no. So he'd get himself into all sorts of trouble on an almost continual basis, where he'd got too much work to do and couldn't actually do it all himself. So he gave me my first cues to write for a film, which were a film called Down and Out in Beverly Hills. Hans did an awful lot of work with Stanley. In fact, they set up a studio together. And that for Stanley was, you know, Hans was always on the cusp of technology, and he just got his Fairlight, and that was a whole new adventure for Stanley, and they had a fantastic collaboration. So that was that, really. And I was then, Hans came over to LA, I guess, to do Rain Man. And I didn't see him probably for a couple of 3 years. And I was still working away in England. I started to do a bit of TV and some film music there, but nothing of much import. But I was in LA doing some Tina Turner records, playing. And when I finished that, I had to get on a plane and go to Germany to do something. I just arranged for a symphony orchestra, but ended up spending the night talking to young Hans, who was thrilled to renew acquaintance. And from there on in, really, we did a lot of work. I'd also moved from England to Virginia, where I now live. People say, why do you live in Virginia? I said, well, from England, I got halfway to LA and thought that's probably close enough. So both being in the same country, and he would often need help with projects. So I ended up working on a lot of films with him. I learned an awful lot with him, and we had a lot of fun. You know, we've known each other for, 25, 30-ish years. So it's a long time, and I still do work with him, and it's fantastic. I love doing my own stuff, and Man in the Iron Mask was one of the first films that I was asked to do really on my own. I did a a rush of three of them all over in LA. Fire Down Below for Steven Seagal, Home Alone 3 for Roger Gosnell, and then Man in the Iron Mask for Randall Wallace, the director. I joined halfway through filming, I guess. Randall was back in LA. Maybe he'd almost finished filming, but they filmed it all in France, and I know he had to go back there a couple of times. But the post-production happened in LA, and we had a meeting, and he offered me the job, and I said I'd love to. And so it was towards the end, but I had plenty of time. It wasn't one of those, oh, we've just realized we need music. And there's 3 weeks to go, which happens quite often. Well, not that's an exaggeration, but only barely an exaggeration. So I had plenty of time. And then finding, you know, what I always do is just write some ideas. I'd seen the script for the film. I don't think I'd seen any edit of it as yet, but I knew pretty much what it was. So I just started putting some themes together. I just make a long, you know, 9-minute suite of themes. That's how I approach most projects usually. And the first show and tell, you know, the director comes around to see the composer wonders whether he's going to like what he's going to play. I woke up really early in the morning, like sort of 4 or something, and I had this completely formed tune in my head. So I thought, oh God, well, he's coming around in 5 hours. I'd better... So I got in the studio and just put it on the end of the sequence and sat him down and played him from the beginning. And he listened all the way through, and he's, it's just really nice. Can you just play that last bit again? So I played him, you know, the bit that I just literally arrived at that very morning. And that became the main theme, I suppose. And then, you know, it's set in, you know, in olden France, in olden days, but I didn't want the music to be... I wanted it to have elements of what was typical at the time, but also have elements of modernity about it as well, which is why there's lots more percussion than there ever would have been in those days, and a lot of it's played more aggressively than it would have been in those days. So, and I wanted to have, you know, voices, dark choir for the dark in the prison, poor old chap in the iron mask, and some lighter elements for the more fun bits, if you like. And then obviously it's got some action for the battle sequences. Most films are always a collaboration between composer and either director or producer, whoever has the more powerful voice in the organisation, I guess. And they've been living with their project for 1 or 2 years usually, and here comes the composer 5 weeks before finishing. And, you know, they obviously, I like to write something that is kind of what they want, but also is more than what they want. And sometimes they didn't even know they wanted it to go that direction. That's always nice when they go, oh, I'd never seen it like that, but he really nailed it. That's always a lovely thing to happen. I guess, you know, usually I'll get together. That I was writing out in LA, Randall was in LA, so we'd get together every 3 or 4 days and I'd just play him what I'd done. And yes, that's great, or no, that sucks, or that's great, can we just try this? And, you know, so you end up, you know, then another thing that's happened in the last 20 years is that in the olden days, a director would go to a composer's apartment or whatever, and they'd have a piano, and that was it, because, you know, there may have been a mini Moog hanging around, but it wouldn't plug into anything. And there'd be a metronome and some sort of VCR, and you'd prod the play button, and the metronome would go, and you'd sort of say, well, it goes like this, and you're plonking away on the piano, and it says, well, we have big drums here, and this will be played on French horns, and we'll have some high strings. Poor director doesn't really have a clue. But, it, you know, if he likes the tune and what you're telling him, then on you go. But, you know, the surprise that a director must have had when they first went to a scoring stage for their film to suddenly hear this music that they'd never heard before. Whereas these days, you know, email files off to somebody, they can put it in their laptop in Final Cut Pro and hear a very good sounding demo and have a conversation about it 5 minutes later, which is great because they have the confidence. And it's great for me as well. I don't, you know, in the old days, a lot of times you'd have people where the director would have a problem with the cue and because he hadn't heard it properly before, and you got 90 guys sitting there while you're trying to rewrite a cue. It's a, you know, it's a waste of money, a waste of, you know, it's a waste of everybody's energy, basically. It's much better to get it completely right first and then just go and record it. Well, the music, first of all, must not ever overpower the film. It must serve the film at all times. Otherwise, you're going to get struck down by the directors. Why is your music bigger than my film? I think, you know, I think it's a common mistake made by a lot of people these days where they just want too much music in a film. You know, you get these films that have almost wall-to-wall music. And when the effect of that on writing is that if you never stop, you can't start. And how you start a piece is sometimes the most magical thing of what the music does, the way it will change the emotion just by the fact there's no music and then there is something. I also kind of look at music as you've got to watch the whole curve of the film. You've got to be aware of whether you're going to be writing thematic motifs that are character related or motif, you know, everybody's traveling for now, so we're going to have a sort of traveling tune, you know what I mean? But it's almost like there's this thread of cards that is each different scene in the film, and you're just pushing a needle with some thread through all these cards, and you're just gradually nudging it so it just feels a more tightly assembled thing. It's like emotional glue, I guess. One of the best films ever, I think, as an example of no score and all source music was Pulp Fiction. Absolutely fantastic job, because you're always drawn in, you know, the music's always drawing you into the film. Then I thought another fantastic concept, not in terms of mixing modern music, but was it Stowaway, Tom Hanks' film? Castaway. Yeah, on Castaway, as soon as he's on the island, the music stops. And the next time there's any score is when he actually breaks into that first wave and is finally released for the album. I thought it was a very clever concept. It's also great to only have to write 14 minutes of music for a film. But I think in general, there's a lot of films where they're obviously thinking at the back of their minds, oh, we've got a soundtrack album here, and they're putting things into the film just because they've got this CD deal, and a lot of it doesn't really belong there, I don't think. So I think sometimes the film gets diluted by people wanting to cram things where they don't really belong in the film, but sometimes it can work really well. You know, another common problem is that, you know, for us, from the scoring side, they're always, the editors and directors are using other people's score CDs as temporary music, and they can put some great pieces of music and then cut their film to that pacing, so you're kind of locked into writing something with that tempo, otherwise it doesn't work. And similarly with pop songs, they'll put a Rolling Stones one in there, followed by a Phil Collins one in there, and then suddenly they say, oh, we didn't realise that this is going to cost $700,000 just for 20 seconds of Phil Collins. And, you know, then if they can't have that, then, oh, are we going to score it instead? And that's like that's a poor replacement if that's what they want. But, you know, every situation has its own vices and virtues.